Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Bridge. I have overall responsibility for public events in the Law Department, which is why I'm going to introduce tonight's interviewer and interviewee. But just a couple of words, first of all, about the Legal Biography Project. This is very much a neglected area in legal scholarship, and the LSC has for some few years now been making an attempt to repair that deficiency. There are various ways in which the biography project conducts itself. One is a public interview of this sort. Another might be a working group or party. Another might be an event like a visit to Lincoln's Inn. Another possibility still is a collaboration with the British Library, currently under progress, on oral histories. If you want to know more about the Legal Biography Project, then you'll find plenty of information on the departmental website. Now, the next thing is that we are very pleased indeed to have Lady Justice Arden here as the subject of tonight's interview. The Legal Biography Project has an advisory panel chaired by Mr. Justice Ross Cranston, who will be conducting the interviews. Lady Justice Arden, as you all surely know, has had an illustrious career on the courts for some years now. She's a former chair of the Law Commission. She grew up in Liverpool, and she grew up at a time when it was perfectly possible, I think, to go to the Cavern and listen to the Beatles. Possible also to catch a ferry across the Mersey. I don't know whether that particular aspect of her career is going to come out tonight. I think we're all waiting in a sense of trepidation to find out more. But the less I say, the better, and I think I should at this point yield now to the true subjects of tonight's event. Lady Justice Arden and Mr. Justice Ross Cranston.
Well, thanks very much, Michael. I can now turn the first page because you've taken most of that, including Liverpool. But I'm delighted to be able to do this. I've known Mary for many years. Her official title, of course, is the Right Honourable Dame Mary Arden, Lady Justice Arden. We're going to come back to titles a bit later on this evening. Michael has touched very briefly on the stellar career, but I hope at the end of the hour you will have an appreciation of Mary much more as a person, and you'll know much more about what she's done. She's not just been a judge. Well, let's start where Michael mentioned in Liverpool, because that's where you grew up. Your grandfather was a solicitor and had a law firm, and your father went into that firm. Can you tell us something about your family background and why? I mean, was this? Did you want to be a lawyer because your grandfather had been a lawyer? My daughter doesn't want to do anything with law. She reacted against it, but you obviously took to it.
Yes, I certainly did take to it. What happened in my family was that a long way back we had a member of the family, an ancestor, who became Chief Justice and Master of the Rolls, and that was 200 years ago. Now, it's a fairly distant relationship, but my father always used to talk about it, and clearly my grandfather would have done, though I never met him. And they were both solicitors, but this ancestor had first been a Member of Parliament, and then he'd become Attorney General, and then he had found himself the only judicial office which you could then hold as well as a seat in Parliament. His seat in Parliament was a rotten borough in the Isle of Wight, but he did become Master of the Rolls, and he became Master of the Rolls at a very exciting time, at the time of the French Revolution. Yeah. He died in 1804, and he is buried in the Rolls Building in Chancery Lane.
But did you go in as a little girl into the family firm and sit at the desk and take out the ledgers, or?
Well, yes, in the holidays I did from time to time go in and do things like write out conveyances and abstracts of conveyances, which was the way it was all done in those days, by copperplate writing. It took a long time. Also, there were no photocopiers. It makes me sound as if I'm antediluvian, but actually in the 1960s, photocopiers weren't generally used. And we had a process whereby the letter was typed, it was then put onto a piece of blotting paper with a piece of wet cloth above it, and then another piece of paper, and then there was a large machine that looks like a bookbinding machine, and you would push down this large screw and take a copy in that way. And that's why you sometimes see old carbon copy letters which look as if they're pale blue ink.
Yeah.
So yes, of course, as a child I did have the opportunity to see inside the office.
So, I mean, you might have become a solicitor, but you wanted to be a barrister.
No, my father had this great ambition that he would have a firm which was called Arden Son and Daughter. No one had done that. I wasn't very keen on becoming a lawyer when I was at school, and I really wanted to be a doctor because I thought that was a more caring profession. And so I worked on maths and biology, but then I found my maths and my science weren't that good, so I had to fall back on something else. We didn't have a career advisor, so the natural thing seemed to be to become a lawyer. It was certainly much more interesting to me than becoming a teacher or one of the other things that was generally offered.
So you went to school in Liverpool, to a college. It was a girls' school.
Yes.
What would be called a SWAT, or were you into games, or were you doing both, or?
I wouldn't call myself a SWAT at all. I was not, as it were, top of the class and always producing lots of work. We played an enormous amount of games, and I remember playing a lot of cricket. But I couldn't tell you now what the rules of cricket are. We played cricket, hockey, lacrosse, netball, everything, and did a lot of sport. And we also had something which would nowadays not be in school, namely a domestic science block, where you would put on an apron and learn how to cook. It has been useful, I have to say.
Yeah. So when did you decide you were going to... I mean, you went to Cambridge... did you decide you were going to be a lawyer? You said you were thinking about being a doctor, but you then decided to be a lawyer. About what age was that? In your mid-teens, or?
Yes, in my sixth form years.
Just before we go, we come to university. I mean, Michael touched on Liverpool, you know, the Beatles and the Beat Poets and all the rest of it. I mean, was that after you'd left, or that going on, or did you ever go to the Cavern, I think it was called?
Well, I'm sorry to disappoint you, and I didn't go to the Cavern, but Liverpool is a very vibrant city. It's a complete mixing bowl of people. It has the oldest Chinese community, because they came after the Opium Wars. There's a very big Caribbean community, Polish community, and so it is a tremendous mixture. And so it is a very lively city. Apart from that, the people have a sense of fun, and they are just natural actors. They are also tend to speak with and make jokes of their language, of the use of language. Mm. So they've got a huge sense of outgoing, and I thoroughly enjoy Liverpool. I think it's a great place.
Yeah. So you then go to Cambridge and read law. Now, were there many women doing law at that stage?
Absolutely not. I was one of 5 out of 110 in our lecture hall, which was the first year in my college that they had decided to take a large number of women. Ahead of me by 2 years was, or at least 1 year, was Lady Hale, and 2 years after me there was Mrs. Justice Gloucester. And you're going to say, I hope, why choose Girton?
Why choose Girton?
Yes, I went to Girton College, Cambridge.
Yeah.
And the great thing about Girton was that it was set up in 1873, and it was one of the first colleges to provide university education for women. And they were very keen to make sure that you realise that. That was all part of the atmosphere and the tradition. It was also able to embrace new things because it was the first college in Cambridge to go co-educational. So as from 1977, it's been men and women, and it's been pretty much balanced, equal numbers of men and women. But they did have, back in 1873, when the college was first set up, a very strong sense of purpose about educating women. And you've got to remember that in Cambridge, and I don't know what the position was in other universities, women didn't get degrees until 1948. So that meant there was that whole period of time when women were studying and also taking the exams and getting the grades, but not getting the degree. So you can imagine what a hard task Girton had in Cambridge. It was discreetly built 2 miles out of Cambridge, and it's a very big place. It looks just like the Royal Courts of Justice. You would, if you didn't know, you would think they were designed by the same people.
Yes. Well, you will remember you took me there to
a dinner.
Honorary Fellows dinner, yes, and you impressed me with all the formidable women on the wall who had done great things. I mean, what was life like there? Were you, again, obviously a keen student, but I mean, did you take to any particular subjects? You later became a company lawyer. Was that nurtured at Cambridge?
It was,
or?
But not until my fourth year. We were in a very privileged position because our director of studies, whose name is Mrs. Jolovitz, was married to a professor at Trinity College, and she was therefore able to access the best dons for teaching her group of Girtonians. So we had really the people who were leading in all their fields, people like Tony Weir, Tony Jolovitz, Gareth Jones, Clive Parry, Kurt Lipstein, mm-hmm. and Justin May, name a few. So we were extremely lucky. And every subject we took, of course, that was the best subject because we had the best teacher and they were very stimulating. Mm-hmm. I think some of you may have known about Tony Weir, who died last year, but he was always full of colourful phrases. Mm-hmm. And he made supervisions, as we call them, such fun. Mm-hmm. So, I loved the subjects I did. I suppose I particularly liked the subjects equity, which Gareth Jones taught, private international law, which Kurt Lipstein taught. And it wasn't until my fourth year that I did any company law.
And was that Len Seeley, was it?
No, it was Len Seeley in part. It was also a very distinguished South African lawyer called Ken Polak, who was at King's and who sadly died very shortly after that. But he was an extraordinarily good teacher.
Yeah. And you stayed the 4 years?
Yes.
Because you did the LLB, what used to be the LLB after?
I did. Which was a much lighter course than doing the BCL in Oxford. But it gave me a chance to think what I wanted to do, and it was in the fourth year and the third term that I decided I would join Gray's Inn and go to the bar.
Yes. So you weren't tempted by academic life, because some of my former colleagues are here and
I never
tempted by becoming a teacher of law.
I have at various points in my career thought it would be a wonderful thing to do, and I never undervalue the contribution which academe makes, and where possible I read into it, but I've never thought of it as a whole career. So what I was thinking was, at the end of the fourth year, well, it did look as if the barristers did all the exciting cases.
Mm. But you didn't go to the bar straight away, because you went off to the States.
Yes.
You became a Kentish scholar at Harvard.
I did.
And spent the year there doing the LLM. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about that? What was the American experience like? Quite different.
Well,
quite different, I imagine.
I mean, the Kennedy Scholarship had been given one of the ways in which this country commemorated the assassination of President Kennedy and the value of President Kennedy's work. And so there was a fund established, and they sent 12 scholars, some of whom were lawyers, every year. So it was a very wonderful thing to be able to have a scholarship, a Kennedy scholarship. Especially it was to Harvard, and Harvard's in Massachusetts, which is where Kennedy had come from. And there, in those days, when I had it, they liked you to go across by ship. Mm. So we had a chance of being together for the first week. So we were on this ship that left Southampton, waving goodbye to my parents and everything. And then we spent 7 days on this ship. Now, it was the US, United States, which was an aluminium ship built to win the Blue Ribbon, which is the award for getting across the Atlantic in the fastest time. Mm. Which it did, but they forgot to put, or designed it, so they didn't have any stabilizers. And this was in the autumn. We had this very rocky journey all the way to the United States. But one thing you get if you go by ship is that you see, and you go into New York, is you see the horizon opening up in front of you. And you see the arm of the Statue of Liberty. And it's the first part of the United States I saw. It must have been seen by countless immigrants. Mm. But it is a quite striking feature. And that felt terrific.
Mm-hmm. Did you travel around the States in the year?
Yes, I did. But before I say that, it was the most amazing year to go to the United States, because it was a year of huge upheaval. Martin Luther King had very recently been assassinated, so there was a lot of racial tension in the South. It was a great loss to the States. Robert Kennedy had been assassinated, and he was standing for the Democratic presidency. And there had been shootings at Kent University of students. People were being drafted in vast numbers, and this was a topic of conversation in my age group, because people were worried about when they were going to get their conscription papers, when they'd be sent to Vietnam. There were a vast number of people being killed in Vietnam. The war looked as if it could never be won. And Eugene McCarthy was going around the United States with a campaign of peace at any price. So it was a foment of activity. A lot of unrest in my particular age group. And it was just a great year to be there. So Harvard, which is was comparatively far removed from these, because it was a very intense scholarly institution, but you couldn't help but be aware of what was going on in the US. And the US was on a slide downwards.
Well, you'd see it every night on the 6 o'clock news, quite apart from talking to students and so on. I mean, what just in terms of the, just to go back to the law, the legal education, I mean, what contrast did you see between legal education in the States and here?
Well, firstly,
did you appreciate the American approach?
Appreciate in sense of value, most certainly, yes. Mm. Firstly, when I opened the list of courses I could take, there weren't the usual 7 for every year that I'd found in Cambridge. There were about 60, so you had to make your choice. Then I found that the courses were rapidly being renamed because of all this unrest, so that insolvency law, if I'd wanted to take that, was in fact now called debtors' rights. And there was a lot of specialist courses, so people who had a particular interest in, let's say, conflict resolution in Colombia would be teaching a course about conflict resolution, so there were a lot of cameo courses. But there were also very famous people there. I was very, very lucky. Lon Fuller, the philosopher, was teaching. Chadbourne, Keaton on torts, attended all their courses. Louis Loss on security regulation. And first of all, there was just this vast amount of choice. And then when you got into the subject, it was taught in a different way, because you were given a case book, which is a book which looked more like a coffee table. It's about this high, and you're expected to read about 150 pages every day and absorb some case and then discuss it in the class. So there was a completely different way of teaching. But I soon worked out that you could actually get through this process provided you produced an answer of some kind, because with 53 states, you were pretty well bound to find some state court that had decided it as you, in the loony way that you thought it might have been decided. So it was great fun.
Yeah. Was there any, you mentioned a number of the professors, I mean, was there anyone in particular who struck you?
Lon Fuller.
Lon Fuller.
It has to be Lon Fuller.
Yeah,
he would sit there and puffing a cigarette, and he had this great halo around him, but every word he spoke was beautifully calibrated, and he thought about things very hard.
It was what was he teaching?
Philosophy of law.
Yes. You did that, but you tended to specialise in corporate securities type courses.
Yes, I had, as it were, majored on company law as a reason for going to Harvard. And what I planned was, what I thought was, well, there must be plenty of company law at the bar, so let's do company law here, give myself a comparative aspect. I have to say, having an experience of comparative law has been extraordinarily useful. That's really been valuable, because you look at things with different perspectives. You look at a problem and see how somebody else has solved it, coming from a different direction. You have to remember, legal policy can be different in different jurisdictions, but comparative law for me is extraordinarily important.
Yeah. You then come back to this country, you become a pupil at Erskine Chambers, which specializes in company law. I mean, how did you just write out of the blue, or?
Oh, no, that wasn't possible.
Wasn't done like that.
No. Erskine Chambers was then 24 old buildings. 24 old buildings in Lincoln's Inn had suffered a fire a couple of years previously and had been rebuilt internally. As a result of that, they had cloakrooms suitable for men and separate cloakrooms for women. So for the first time in their lives, the set of chambers where I did pupillage felt they were able to have some women pupils. Because if in the past, when chambers had had women pupils, they had had to go to the Royal Courts of Justice if they wished to use the bathroom. So this was the first time. They took three. They took Mrs. Justice Gloucester, as she now is, the wife of the Singaporean ambassador, and myself. Now, how did I get pupillage? Well, that in itself is a story. My father knew someone whose nephew was a young solicitor at Slaughter and May, a firm of solicitors, he understood it, in the City of London. And his friend said, well, I'll just simply ask my nephew if he could find a pupillage. And he just rang up the clerk to the leading barrister in Company Law and said, we know somebody who would like pupillage. And that's how I got it. I wouldn't have got it otherwise.
Yeah. And of course, they don't do it that way these days.
Definitely not. No. It has to be a competition.
Yeah. There's an interesting story about when you were a junior barrister, because you tried to set up a nursery for children of barristers, but that failed.
Yes, I got married 2 years after I came to the bar, and I was expecting my first child 3 years after that. And I thought how wonderful it would be if there was a bar nursery in the Temple area, whereby so that women who had small children and were barristers could bring their children in, leave them there, and collect them at the end of the day, and indeed see them in the course of the day if they wanted to do so. So I circulated all the women barristers, and we put something together. I have to tell you, it was not a success. It was no more successful than the current proposal.
What, I mean, was there resistance or just no support? Firstly,
there weren't that many women barristers, and then there were practical problems about, well, do I really want to bring my child into London if I'm going out on the Western Circuit and so on? But also, I suppose events overtook me. I had the children, I had to find a nanny, so I went on that way.
Yeah.
I would like it to have happened. It would have been a great thing to have happened.
I mean, you say that the chambers took on three women, but especially in that area, company law, corporate law, commercial law, I mean, even these days, there aren't a huge number of women.
Oh, they only took them on for pupillage. At the end of pupillage, we were on our own. So,
but you were taken on?
Off I went into Lincoln's Inn. I had a lovely further 6 months fixed up for me with John MacDonald, Queen's Counsel. That was a story in itself, because in a few days of being there, some delightful gentleman dressed from head to toe in most wonderful flowing robes appeared, and they turned out to be the Barnabans, who brought the case of Tito and Wardell, which occupies a huge amount of the law reports.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a great experience. Mm-hmm. But no, my 24-year-old buildings, as they then were, did not offer me a tenancy. The reason was they did not think that any woman would succeed in that area of work. Mm. So off I went. It is fair to say there were only two other women practicing in Lincoln's Inn at that time, only two other women barristers.
Mm.
And so it was not as I had hoped it would be. There was only one set of chambers doing exclusively company law, and they were fairly small. And secondly, there weren't very many women.
So what happened? I mean, where did you get your tenancy?
All credit goes to the chambers, because they said to themselves, we're going to reconsider this and we're going to give her a go. Mm. So they invited me back. Mm. And first of all, I did a lot of devilling.
Yeah.
Which is when you work as a barrister with another barrister and you're paid for doing that work. Mm. So you don't appear in court on your own. And it's like everything in life. If you just let a woman get on with it, it'll be fine. I remember when John Kennedy was standing as president, there was a huge amount of debate about whether it was right to have a Catholic, as he was, holding office as president of the United States. He might have divided loyalties. He might ask the Pope what to do next. And he had seriously to give a speech saying that he wouldn't do that. But actually, he got appointed. He didn't allow his Catholicism or his religion to stand in the way. He was one of the most successful presidents ever. And nobody has ever since asked, can we have a Catholic as president? Mm. So it's the same with women. G- given the chance, we can do it. Mm. And I'm pleased to say that I got plenty of work, and I made a lot of friends and established contacts, and I don't recall people saying, oh, that's, we can't have a woman on this sort of work.
Mm. You obviously were very successful because you took silk at a very young age, a relatively young age. Now, when you're a QC, you know, normally the work changes. I think you did a big company investigation, which is not unusual for company silks. I mean, can you say something about that? Say something about the work and something about that in particular.
Yes, I mean, the work did change when I became a silk. I think taking silk is a key that opens a lot of doors because people, you have that added status and people think that you can do all sorts of things. And the nature of my practice changed, and I also travelled abroad because English silks are also in demand in other places like Bermuda, Bahamas, Cayman. I was particularly interested in Bermuda. So for many months a year, I would not be necessarily in Lincoln's Inn. So silk changed my life, and it also changed the nature of the work that I did.
Mm. But what about this company investigation?
Yes, Rotoprint was the name of the company. It had had shares which had suddenly gone up in value and then collapsed. And there had been some accounting irregularities, and we had to obviously have a lot of witnesses and then write a long report. When I say we, I was appointed jointly with an accountant. It was great to do it in combination with someone from a different discipline.
Yeah. You're in silk for about 6 or 7 years, and then you get the call from the Lord Chancellor, who was Lord Mackay, who we also interviewed as part of this project. And he offers you an appointment to the High Court. Mm. Can you tell us about what happened?
I had been out for a long walk on a Saturday, and we got in very late, and there was a note in the kitchen saying, from our French au pair, which said, Lord Chancellor rang. I have to tell you, that didn't happen in our household, so I did rather suggest that she'd got her English wrong. Anyway, she was determined the Lord Chancellor had rung. So I didn't know anything about it, and on Monday I got a call to go and see him, which I did. And so, of course, it's always put to you on the basis it's absolutely the logical thing to do. You can't possibly refuse my offer, can you? Mm. So there it was.
And you didn't say, I want to think about it, you said?
Oh, I certainly wanted to think about it, but I decided in the end. Mm. I decided that the time had come. I'd been in silk long enough, and that I certainly always wanted to be a judge. So that was fine.
Yeah. Well, you were a very young judge, actually.
Yes.
But you'd always want to be a judge. You haven't told me that.
Yes, I think so, because I enjoy the law for finding solutions. The great thing, as Lenny Hoffman said to me, about being a judge is you can decide it the way you want to decide it.
Mm-hmm. You became Mrs. Justice Arden.
Mm.
You have told me on other occasions you tried to get that changed.
Yes, I did, because Arden is my own name, so I didn't much like having Mrs. Justice Arden. It seemed to me A, wrong, but B, unnecessary in the modern age. But likewise, I didn't really want to be called Miss Justice. So I put it to my colleagues, by that I mean the whole of the High Court bench, that we ought to be called Justice.
Mm.
And I campaigned on this for quite a while. I had very little support, so it remains as it is, and you are Mr. Justice Krantz.
Yes. Well, other countries have changed it. Absolutely. I think all other countries have changed it. But anyhow, there we are. Now, you're appointed to the Chancery Division.
Yes.
Which, again, is a first.
Yes, first woman.
First woman in the Chancery Division. I mean, maybe people don't understand the different divisions of the High Court. Maybe you can explain the type of work Chancery judges do as opposed to other other divisions of the court.
The easiest way, I think, although it may not be the first way one thinks of, is to say that the Chancery Division does mainly disputes connected in some way with property. So it does company, insolvency, real property, intellectual property, tax, and so on. So those are the areas in which it specialises. And the judges do not go out on circuit and do crime. The judges may go out now for a limited number, may go out for specific purposes and also to specific circuits. But by and large, Chancery judges are based here in London, and they account for about 15 or 20% of the High Court judges. The vast majority of judges are Queen's Bench judges.
How did you find appointment as a judge? Some colleagues will tell you that it's a much more lonely life than being at the bar, or in my case, in the academic world. You're constantly dealing with cases. You don't have large amounts of time to go around talking to people. How did you find it?
The first thing is, I suppose it is a much more isolated existence if you let yourself do it, let that happen. But secondly, they always tell you when you become a judge, you're going to be in control of your timetable, and you'll have far less work. When you're at the bar, you can't turn it away because you think the next brief won't come if you do. I have to say, I haven't noticed any difference in the workload. It is at least as great as when you're at the bar. But you do have more control. You can decide, for instance, the order you take witnesses, or how long counsel will spend on a particular point, or how much paperwork they produce and so on. So you have more control over it, that's certainly so.
Now, again, within a relatively short period, you sort of change tack because you chair the Law Commission for 3 years.
That was also down to the Lord Chancellor.
So what happened? He again, James Mackay, was it?
Yes. And he said, I think you'd be interested in the Law Commission, which I certainly was. It was absolutely fascinating work. You don't realise it from the outside. When you get in there, you realise, firstly, it's got a huge human resource, people who are very anxious and committed to doing law reform, and very thorough, very hardworking, extraordinarily able. And then also there are a lot of exciting ideas being bandied around. So it was a great experience for 3 years.
Did you take an interest in any particular project they were doing?
Well, commissioners take collegiate responsibilities, so every project you have to read up and be satisfied about. The other commissioners all had large teams of lawyers, so the first thing I thought was, well, why doesn't the chairman have a lawyer, or the chair have a lawyer? So eventually I persuaded the powers that be that I should have a lawyer, and I too did a project of my own.
Which was?
Shareholder remedies.
We
had it was the first time that I think the DTI had instructed the Law Commission to do a project, and I worked closely with them, and it's all about Foss and Harbottle.
Did that lead to legislation?
It led to a set of recommendations, some for new legislation, which now appear in the Compass Act 2006.
Well, let's jump to that because it anticipates, but there was a big company law revision, and in fact, Michael Bridges' predecessor was very involved in that, from the LSE, Paul Davis. You were involved in that as well.
Yes,
so you didn't give away the law reform aspect of your interests.
When I finished the Law Commission, I went on with company law reform. What happens is, about every 20 years or so, there has to be a new Companies Act. And it generally consolidates the old act and makes some changes. Now, what had happened in the 1990s was that the DTI had a vast number of things they wanted to change, but no parliamentary time. So when the new government came in 1997, they hit on a great idea, which was to set up a whole-scale review of company law. And it wasn't just to be lawyers in charge of it. It was to be financial journalists, captains of industry, accountants, completely across the board, and a very distinguished, some very distinguished academics, including the late John Parkinson, who wrote a brilliant book on company law. And we worked for 3 years, and at the end we produced a final report. There were many reports on the way and consultative documents. The chair was a senior official from the DTI. And then the question was, would the government support the recommendations? And they supported pretty much everything. So then they had a draft bill, and in 2005 they presented the Companies Bill, which became the Companies Act, and I would like everyone to know it is the largest statute ever passed by the British Parliament. It had the largest number of amendments ever introduced. So it was a mammoth undertaking.
Let's go back to the Law Commission. You finished at the Law Commission. You then was appointed to the Court of Appeal.
No, you've jumped.
There was a gap.
There was a big gap.
So tell me about that, because I know you've told me in the past about it.
Okay. Well, in chairman of the Law Commission are usually considered Court of Appeal material, because the sort of work you've been doing at the Law Commission, that sort of analysis is useful in the Court of Appeal. When I came back from the Law Commission, I went straight back to the Chancery Division, but I had a huge amount of compensatory leave. So I said to the Vice-Chancellor, as he then was, Sir Richard Scott, I'd like to use it. And what's more, I said, since we've got in the Human Rights Act, I'm going to go to Strasbourg. And he looked at me with complete amazement. Go to Strasbourg? So I eventually arranged for myself to go to Strasbourg, and the court was extremely generous. I had a room, a computer, I had access to all the papers, and I sat down and worked through cases. I went to deliberations of the judges, I talked to the judges. This is someone who has never done any human rights. I could tell you which was Strasbourg and Luxembourg, but it didn't go much further than that. So I had this complete immersion in human rights. I found it fascinating, because I'm not only seeing human rights for the first time, I was seeing it across the convention countries. So seeing cases from Bulgaria, it never occurred to me to look at the legal system for Bulgaria or Romania or a place like that, and it was a very fascinating and important time. While I was there, I had a telephone call, not this time from the Lord Chancellor, but from the Vice Chancellor, saying, when are you coming back? Apart from that, he said, the judge, the UK judge, can't sit on two cases because he dealt with them at the Human Rights Commission. And since you're out in Strasbourg, why don't you sit on them? So I said, that's great. So I had now, not only did I have my status as a student, as it were, in Strasbourg, I now had the status of being an ad hoc judge. I don't think it was appreciated by the Vice-Chancellor that the two cases he'd given me were extremely important cases for the British legal system. One of them was about the duty of care. And Strasbourg had had a case where the courts here had said, no duty of care, it's Hill and Chief Constable. When you have a police and they are sued for breach of the duty of care in relation to something they did in relation to an investigation, then there's no duty of care. And Strasbourg saw this and they put up their hands and they'd said in an earlier case, good heavens, no access to court, there must be a violation of Article 6. And they had ruled it was a violation of Article 6. If this continued, they maintained this line, it means that the whole law of negligence would have to be rewritten, because we couldn't have a duty of care, because we couldn't find there was no duty of care without incurring the convention liability. So I was faced with a case which had come subsequently to the case in which they'd made that decision, which was called Osman, a case called Zed, and it involved not policemen but some children who had been grossly neglected by social services in Bedfordshire, and the House of Lords in Exon, Bedfordshire, had held there was no duty of care.
Yeah. Famous case, yeah.
So that was my first experience of collegiate judging.
Yes. So what happened? I mean, do you have to explain to all these judges from other jurisdictions about the English law of tort?
Well, the deliberations are, of course, confidential, but it was a court of 17 or even 19 Grand Chamber, and the case was, they did have an oral hearing, which is unusual, and it took about 2 years to get the judgment out. During that time, I was learning the importance of working closely with your colleagues in collegiate judgment, getting to talk to them, make sure they've understood the issues.
Does that mean you kept on going back over those 2 years?
About every 6 months, yes. Yeah. But also keeping in touch with them. And eventually, the judgment came out, and the Strasbourg Court is not, of course, bound by precedent. They decided that they had perhaps taken a step which didn't need to be taken, and which didn't fully appreciate domestic law, so that they did decide that we could decide whether or not there was a duty of care without violating Article 6, and we could do it by a summary process, no violation of Article 6. So this was the first time when there was a dialogue between, as it was then, the House of Lords and Strasbourg. the very first time, and I saw it absolutely at close quarters.
I mean, you, again, we're sort of jumping ahead a bit, but I mean, you have written, you know, a considerable number of articles, including about dialogue. Mm. But I mean, you've touched on a whole range of issues from your own area, like commercial law, through to human rights. I mean, this is not usual for judges. I mean, some judges do outside writing, but you've given a lot of speeches and written a lot of articles. I mean, is this just because you're interested, or is there something...
Just because I have
frustrated
something to
novelist,
say.
Or
frustrated academic, I thought you were going to say. I've always chosen a subject which has not been dealt with as I see it before, or an angle that's not been dealt with. Mm-hmm. So, as you say, I've written about dialogue between the European supranational courts and our own senior courts. I've also written about subjects as technical as prospective overruling, which is when the court decides that its decision will only have prospective effect or make some similar order. And it was virtually never discussed in this jurisdiction, but I was out in Australia, and I heard the judges there say, well, they didn't think it was part of the judicial function in the common law system to have prospective overruling. So I then did a lot of research around the world and wrote a note for the LQR, and as luck would have it, somebody picked it up, and they then cited it in a case in the House of Lords, and the House of Lords then...
Well, I argued Evans before the House of Lords.
You had a case called...
Evans. Which was about prospective overruling.
That's right,
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's been a whole range of subjects. Terrorism, another one, and I'm going to give a speech in March about media intrusion, because I want to talk about the role of Strasbourg cases in that.
Let's go back. I mean, you were appointed to the Court of Appeal, and you're now a very senior member of the Court of Appeal. I mean, you've obviously in your career decided hundreds of cases. There's just one example, Evans and Amicus. And I choose that partly because you mentioned it to me, but also because it's an interest here at the LSE. Medical law, it was intro fertilisation.
Yes.
Do you want to say something about that?
Yes. Just like to say a little bit about it, if the listeners would just bear with me for a moment. This was a case about a woman called Natalie Evans, and she had been told that she had very serious cancer of the ovaries, and she would have to have them removed almost immediately. And that would mean that she wouldn't have her own biological children, she would have her ovaries removed. But she would be able to have children in future. So they said, why not let us preserve, by cryopreservation, some of your eggs so that you could have your own eggs implanted and you would then have your own biological children. But to do this, they said, your partner must fertilize the eggs because they would be preserved much better that way. So her partner came along and he agreed, and the eggs were fertilized and put into cryopreserved state. She had the operation, and then she decided she would like the eggs implanted so that she could have children. By that time, she and her partner had broken up, and she, the clinic where the eggs were stored, then wrote to him and asked him whether he consented to the eggs being implanted in her so she could have her own children. And he wrote back saying, no, I don't want to know that my children are growing up anywhere. So there was a complete conflict of interest. She wanted to have her own children. He didn't. They weren't together, so he wouldn't have had the children. But, of course, there might have been a risk that he would be financially liable for those children in some way. But it meant a lot to her. So she came to the courts. She had to argue that this was permitted, what she wanted was permitted under our legislation, which is the Human Fertilization and Embryology Act of 1990. She failed on that. It required consent, both courts held, both the High Court and the Court of Appeal, to implantation as well as to treatment. So she failed on that. And then she said, well, what about Article 8? I have a right under the Convention to have a family life, to respect for my family life. She failed on that in our courts too. So she took her case to Strasbourg, and she first went to the first level in Strasbourg, and they turned her down, and then she went to the Grand Chamber. So she went all the way through the process. And it was a very interesting judgment of the Grand Chamber, because it's one of the cases in which they say, because there isn't a consensus across member states as to what to do in this situation, we're going to leave it to member state legislation. So she never got to have her own biological children. But it's a very interesting case from absolutely every perspective. From the point of view of Article 8, you have two people relying on Article 8, because she says it's my right to respect for family life, and he says, but it's part of me, and therefore part. I have a right too. So you get two conflicting Article 8 cases. There are philosophical questions galore. For instance, was that an embryo which was capable of being life from the moment it was fertilized and in storage? What was it? And then there are ethical questions as to whether the man should be able to prevent the woman, because the obvious thing is, in the normal way, once the man fertilizes an egg, that's the last time he has any control over the situation. The woman could have an abortion or whatever without his consent. So why should he suddenly be given consent because the egg is in a preserved state?
I was going to say, you wrote a separate judgment and took a different line from some of your colleagues, or from, I think, Stephen Sedley was in the...
Yes, and Justice Thorpe.
Lord Justice Thorpe, yeah.
Absolutely. Well, it was a very fine court apart from myself, but I just felt that being a woman judge, I wanted to say certain things, such as I wanted it to be clear that I had taken into account something which I believed to be the case, which is that having your own children is something which is very important to women, and that, that some women do feel that when they've had their own child, their own biological child, they have a stronger position in society or in the family or whatever. So it becomes particularly important for a woman to have her own biological child. And therefore, I mean, from that you could argue that Natalie Evans's right ought to be given more priority than her partner's. And indeed, I think in Feminist Judgments, a book I would recommend to everybody, there is a judgment which I think has that effect. Mm. I'm glad to say that the law has been changed, that there's now a cooling off period of 12 months. The eggs are not destroyed so that the parties can discuss it for 12 months. Mm.
Mm. I think we might draw it to close, but let me ask you this final question, because you've sort of anticipated it. I mean, what qualities do you think someone needs as a judge, in particular a woman judge?
Well, it's a very difficult question to answer.
What advice would you give to anyone here who wants to be a judge?
Well, obviously I'm looking at it through my own experience, and I suspect things have moved on quite considerably for women than when I first came to the bar. In other words, I think there are probably many more women around and that their chances ought to be better. But you do need to have certain qualities and it seems to me, all the usual ones that every judge requires, like integrity and competence and fair-mindedness. Of course you need those, but I think there's something really further that you require, certainly at an appellate level. I think it's necessary to be creative. I think you must have it in you to want to give every ounce to creating a new solution in the right circumstances. Of course you've got to apply the law, but you can do it creatively. And that's something that you can do in the Court of Appeal. The next thing I think you require is I think you need a huge amount of perseverance. I often think about Robert the Bruce sitting in the cave and watching the spider go up. It had to go up and down 8 times before it made its web. That's the number of times I think that Robert the Bruce had to fight the English before he won. And I think in the case of women, that we are underrepresented, so we don't have enough women in the judiciary or in the legal profession. And I suspect because of that we may be undervalued. And so you've got to just keep on going in the face of what looks like non-acceptance. Mm. Keep on going. So I think I would say creativity, perseverance, and then the third thing, and this is perhaps dangerous territory, I think that a judge needs, particularly a woman judge, and I think women judges are particularly able to do this, is to show empathy. Now, I know I'm in dangerous territory because Obama said that when he was about to appoint Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. And the Republicans immediately turned around and said, what do you mean, empathy? Judges have got to apply the law. They haven't got to be empathetic. But I think you can do both. I think it's terribly important to be empathetic, to understand what's going on in society, because we've got a tremendously fast-moving society. I've seen this in Liverpool in particular, how things have moved very considerably over my lifetime, and that we have to keep the common law up to date. That's what a common law judge does. And so you've got to be able to put yourself in the position of the people who are having to apply the law and who are affected by the law. And so what you're having to do is to be empathetic to their needs in order to do your job of developing the law, of course, in accordance with the law.
Yeah, good. Well, Mary, thanks very much. I mean, we could have discussed other things because you're very involved, for example, in international relations for the judiciary, and you've been involved in judicial discipline and things like that. But I think I'm going to open it up and give an opportunity to people to ask questions. And there's a question up the back. I think we might have, say, take three questions, and then Mary can answer them together. So there's one, and there's one down here. And a third one? And one down here. Okay, so let's start up the back.
Lady Justice Arden, you mentioned, happened to mention, conflict resolution. World peace and prosperity is now very much impeded by intrastate conflicts. Intrastate conflicts are mostly due to the oppression of one section of people by another section in the same country. If I refer to Sri Lanka, where I come from, from the time of independence till today, a lot of Sinhalese, the majority, retired professors, judges, lawyers, civil servants went and told LLRC that from the time of independence till today, we have been oppressing the ethnic minorities. But in the outside world, the oppressed Tamils, first tried for 30 years peaceful parliamentary processes, but they took up arms after 3 decades of failure of peaceful processes. But they were defeated and they were demised 3 years ago. But the rest of the world termed them as terrorists. But this present government also, like previous successive governments, is still oppressing the people, ethnic minorities, under the boots of the occupation army. Do you have any view on this? Oppressed people are called terrorists, but the oppressive regimes are never called terrorists.
Okay, good. Down here.
Yes, thanks.
You may want to introduce yourself, Rosemary.
Oh, okay. My name's Rosemary Upmuti. We have actually met once because you came to speak at Westminster when I was there, but I'm now at Reading. And I teach equity and trust, and so, of course, I teach a number of cases where you've made leading judgments. You've made the law. And one of the things that struck me sometimes with some of these judgments is that the commentaries that we read in things like the Student Law Review or in textbooks or in articles seem to me, and I may just be obsessed with this, but they seem more critical of your judgments than they are of... They express their critique in more critical language than they would if it was a male judge that they were criticising. So they, instead of saying with respect, they will actually say you're wrong sometimes in ways that isn't, that's not very common. And I sometimes point this out to my students, and of course they just think I'm... Well, they just think I'm just too concerned about women and a bit obsessed with that. But I wondered if this is something that you have ever felt yourself. Have you ever felt it? And and if that's the case, how do you deal with it?
Okay, thanks very much. And then down here.
I'm an LLM student, and at the same time a member of Japanese judiciary, and here doing as part of my training and research. And now I read that the UK judicial role is changing from acting as an agency to more dynamic role. And you mentioned three requirements to be a good judge. And do you think that change affects the requirement judges are required to have? And another related question is, if there's something you have been doing through your career on a casual basis or every day, apart from things directly related to law, to improve and maintain your skills you described as to the three requirements?
When I met him before, I was jealous. He's been sent here at the government's expense for 2 years as a judge to have a wonderful time.
Very well. Can I take them the questions in turn?
Yes,
firstly,
which order?
I'm not going to express a view about internal Sri Lankan affairs. I would just like to say that I have visited Sri Lanka. It is one of the most fabulously beautiful places in the world, and it grieves me greatly to think of the violence that is reported there. But what I do strongly feel, now I've seen human rights, now I've learnt about human rights, is that they are a very important way of bringing about peace and security in the world. And I think one of the things that I'm doing as an international judge is trying to promote the rule of law, trying to promote human rights in countries across the world so that I can do a tiny bit towards achieving the end whereby there is more peace and security in our world. Coming to the question about do I think that some commentators are more critical of me, I've never looked at it on a comparative basis. Being a woman, I've always assumed that if they were critical of me, it was my fault. But I'm also very much up to the challenge. I just want to make this clear. If somebody is critical of me, I sit down, work out what I've got to do to meet it. And just this year, I've been thinking very hard about how to write judgments. Subject is intensely interesting, how to turn it all around. So I hope you notice a difference. Now, the next thing, the Japanese judiciary, I have also been to Japan and been the host in the been hosted by the Supreme Court, and I meet many Japanese judges because I think you have colleagues who also come and study in our court system, which we very much appreciate. Of the characteristics which I mentioned, I think creativity has a lot to do with what you're talking about. You were talking about case management. Our judges today are much more into managing the cases. And so if I have an opportunity in the Court of Appeal, as I just have, to manage an appeal, I try and refine the issues so that we've got focused argument. Now, that requires you to find an ad hoc solution in many cases. So that's where your creativity will come in, your ability to take the initiative, your ability to think of something new to solve the problem, because every case is different and every case has its special needs. So I hope that I've answered that point of the question. There was a second point about casual basis. Well, there's a phrase in Latin America, I discovered in Latin America, about we make the road by walking. And I'm a very keen walker, so this one appeals to me. I like walking, and that gives you time to think. But we make the road by walking because we are having to make the path for the first time as women judges. We're having to do that. And so we make the road by walking too. It's their phrase. It comes from a Spanish poet. What he also said, which is a very humbling thing, is that when you look behind you, the road has disappeared. So everyone has to make their own way. And I like walking. That's what I do to rest.
Okay. So Joe, and then here, and then at the back.
Thank you. Jo Braithwaite from LSE. There has been a bit of a debate in the Financial Times over the last week or so that was sparked by the coverage of some very large cases that are coming through between Russian litigants that are taking up a lot of time in court. And the debate's been about whether this should be a cause for us to be quite proud that our courts are being sought out by foreign litigants, or whether it's a cause for concern because of the effect on court time and busyness. And I wondered if you had a view on the court's attractiveness to foreign litigants, particularly in the commercial context.
Mm. Down in the front here.
Hello, Lisa Smanova, LLB student. What a treat it's been to hear about your career path. And I wonder if you could tell us if there have been any particular obstacles, aside from being a woman at the bar. Have there been any obstacles, any particular setbacks where you felt particularly that you've been taken a few paces back, and how you dealt with it all?
Yeah, good. And there was someone up... Yeah.
Hi, I'm Tom Murray, LLB student here. You mentioned the growing importance of judicial diversity, and I wondered if you think a more diverse judiciary would help society as a whole and help judgment, or whether you think that the current judiciary is able to do that. Is able to do that?
Good. Thanks very much. Good. Three good questions.
Very good question. The first point about the debate in the Financial Times as to whether we should allow our court services to be used by foreign litigants. I'm not making any comment about the recent Russian cases, which I'm not involved. The position is that our commercial law is respected across the world, and I'm afraid it's inevitable. People will come here and try and have their cases adjudicated here, and I think we should be proud of it. It's really remarkable when you open the cause list and you find there are hundreds of cases which come from different parts of the world, and that people trust our judges here and have confidence in them. It also puts us in a strong position when it comes to promoting the rule of law and human rights, because we're respected as judges, we're respected as lawyers, and what we say is taken account of, even in the most difficult jurisdiction. So it's something to be proud of. I have had a concern, obviously, about the use of the courts, and it doesn't just affect commercial courts, I'm afraid it's also the family courts. And I'm very concerned that cases about children are brought on quickly. And we want to be very sure that it wasn't being affected by people coming here and asking to have their perhaps divorce cases heard here. So that, I think, is my answer to this. So far as obstacles are concerned, have I found a setback? Yes, of course there have been times in my life when I've said, huh, that shouldn't have happened. But I have to stress this, that my view about that is that it's generally must be my fault. So I go back and think of a way round the obstacle, and generally it works. You have to keep on. You have to keep on the road. It's another brick in the yellow brick road all the time.
Perseverance, as she said earlier.
Yes, perseverance, thank you. And then now, judicial diversity. Of course we need judicial diversity because, and I see this best of all in the Court of Appeal, to decide a case in the best way, you need different points of view. I'm not saying that we haven't got a brilliant judiciary at the moment, apart from myself. We have a judiciary of the highest reputation, but you do need to have different points of view, and therefore you generally need people with different backgrounds and different attitudes. So you need arguments which are capable of being, ones which might be raised by somebody who comes from the Asian community. We have very few people from the Asian community. They would have a different approach to life and be able to bring the richness of their culture into it as well. And likewise, I think we would do better to have diversity in terms of a more equally balanced masculine and feminine judiciary, with masculine and feminine qualities, and also, I think, more disadvantaged people who've had really been got through their career and come to the judiciary with a less advantaged background than many of us. I think it would make the judiciary a much richer place for thinking out new ideas. I would stress, however, there's no evidence that there's not sufficient confidence because we don't have judicial diversity. That isn't the point. I think the point is we don't know how much better we would do if we had the statistical proportions from other parts of the community.
Now, I'm going to take three more and then we'll bring it to an end. Any people burning to ask a question?
I'm probably exhausted.
No? Well, there's one down here. This lady has to identify herself, Marlene.
Hello, my name is Marlene Winfield. I know that you feel passionately about having more women on the bench, and you've just talked about diversity too, and I wonder, I know you've been at it for a long time trying to get more women on the bench. How are we doing, and what do you think would actually change things so that we would have a more diverse judiciary?
Any more? Well, I think you've already had a go after the session, maybe. Any more? Okay, well, we'll take that as the final question.
All right. Well, what I've been able to observe in the last 2 years is that Lord Davis has issued a report in the city saying that there should be more women on boards of the top companies. And lo and behold, within 2 years, the percentage has gone up, I think, from 12 to about 27%. Or less than that, about 17. But anyway, they've done it. They've increased it. What I noticed last year in the Court of Appeal was I had been there 12 years and the percentage hadn't changed. Indeed, I think at one point it had actually marginally gone down, and it's a very small percentage anyway. So there must be more things that we can do. And I think that they probably are, those issues are around a package of issues which would involve more networking, more mentoring, and giving women a chance to do things which perhaps they hadn't done in the past. There's no one obvious silver bullet, I'm afraid, that's going to do it for us. But I would like there to be a pipeline of able women coming from the professions who want to be judges and who see it as a place for women. At the moment, I'm not necessarily sure that the people I talk to at the bar feel that way about it. They don't see any change, so why should it be different for me? And what people don't realize is that if you want to be a judge, then you have to alter your practice a good 5 years or so before you actually get to the stage where you apply for the bench, because it makes a difference. You want to take a certain type of case, if you have any choice about it, or you want to develop your practice in a particular way, or perhaps do some writing, so you've got better qualified to be selected as a judge. So you have to start looking at this pipeline, and you have to see people moving in the pipeline.
Good. Okay, well, thanks to all of you for coming along tonight. In particular, I want to thank you, Mary, for agreeing to do this. I think you'll all agree that there is something more to Mary than simply being a judge. And we've learned a little about that tonight. Unfortunately, we don't have more time to explore some of those issues at greater length. But we're very grateful, and I want all of you to thank Mary for coming along.